Good morning, CHD. Welcome to Pediatric Perspectives. This is where we are looking at children's health challenges from a different perspective, one that includes critical thinking, one that's not afraid to give you the honest truth. I'm your host, Dr. Paul, and I am welcoming back a very special guest, Dr. Michelle Perreault. Welcome, Michelle. It's great to have you back on the show.
Paul, I'm just delighted to be here chatting with you, like one of my favorite pediatricians.
Oh, and you're one of mine. In fact, I'm going to pick your brain on who are all the other great pediatricians in this country. There's a growing number of us folks who have sort of woken up to the fact that the business as usual pediatric care is not making a dent on the challenges that are facing our kids. In fact, that's what we're going to dive in a little bit today. You and I both had journeys where we were mainstream working in critical care, working in general pediatrics, and we realized what we were doing wasn't even making much of a dent. Medicine sort of became a diagnose and treat, and we were just treating symptoms, sort of the end result of something going on that we weren't obviously identifying because we weren't getting these kids better. Maybe just briefly, what were some of the biggest wake-up calls for you as that kind of made you realize, I'm on the wrong path here. I'm not helping my patients.
I had several aha moments. Of course, as many moms, first one was my own son 30 years ago when he had recurrent croup, you know, laryngotracheomalacia, you know, the kind only a pediatrician's kid would get, like, you know, not, they're like blue and not breathing. And I had a serendipitous encounter with an MD homeopath named Dr. Kenze, who still practices. And she told me to give my son a remedy. I gave my son the remedy, and he was better in 5 minutes. Croup again, remedy again, 5 minutes better. Now, I was a pediatric emergency physician, as we just spoke about that, we've shared that commonality. And I was so pissed off, and I say pissed off, I'm a New Yorker, for full disclosure, that there was this system of affordable sugar pills, my son sucked those pills right down, that could reverse something and get to the root cause. When, you know, when we were talking things like injectable epinephrine and steroids and other toxicities, things that I don't like to give children. I never like giving kids steroids. And it took me, I didn't need repeated exposures to that. And I went back, studied homeopathy. And 25 years ago, I became my own homeopath. So that was one. The GMO pesticide issue was number two, which we talked about. That was the other big aha Broadway moment. And I think the third one was when I reversed my first case of autism.
Good.
And I was told, nope, no treatment for autism. You know, some, you know, we can do some counseling, OT, PT. No, there is no treatment. And I reversed it, you know, and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean there's no reversal? This kid just reversed. And that child was older. As kid gets older, it's often harder to reverse autism. And this kid completely reversed. She was 9. And when I saw that, I thought, huh, I just literally had to relearn everything. I didn't believe anything anymore, from cholesterol to iodine to food, and to get off our pharmaceutical training to become, I think I literally trained myself to become a naturopathic physician is what happened over time.
I went through the same path, but before I share my story of the same thing, I had a severely autistic kid. What woke me up was 4 years in a row, I had one of my own patients regress from normal at age 1 to severely nonverbal autistic by age 2. And I was like, okay, this is enough. I can't keep doing this nonsense. And I had, I'll just share mine and then you can share your story. I had already learned from attending certain conferences that are not the Academy of Pediatrics. These are really great conferences that look at real science. And I learned this thing about gluten and dairy and how, you know, food sensitivities could affect things and the gut biome. And this one child at age 4, I'd been working on them for about 2 years to go gluten-free, dairy-free. Oh, it was too hard. It was too hard. They finally did it. He comes back a month later. He had never spoken a word since age 1. Hi, Dr. Thomas, my Thomas Choo-choo, a full sentence. I got goosebumps. I couldn't believe it. Walked out to my partners. I was in a general pediatric practice at that point and said, can you believe this? And they said, oh, you probably misdiagnosed him to be funny. It's like, what? How were you able to get a recovery? And now, folks, if you've struggled with trying to recover your autistic kid, it sometimes isn't that easy. It can be really challenging, but don't give up. But what was your wake-up moment?
I too recognized that I thought 90% of the kids that I saw on the spectrum, and I started seeing a lot of them because I dealt with complex, chronically ill kids, had leaky gut. Which from all the things that we've talked about, the food and pesticides and other toxicants, and concomitant dysbiosis, which is a known microbiome, they all seem to have it. After a while, I used to check their blood for antibodies to foods, gluten, dairy, egg, soy. I mean, I could do it in my sleep. I saw so many. It got to the point I didn't need to do the testing because they all had it. And just started switching to organic, whole foods diets. I removed gluten and dairy, occasionally egg, occasionally soy, but at least gluten and dairy in these kids. And I saw significant improvements, not just the autistic kid, but in the family. I had a mom who told me her asthma cleared. And in my favorite story, a dad who just went organic without the gluten and dairy removal reversed chronic renal failure, kidney failure that he had from living in a pesticide sprayed region of Modesto, 80% kidney failure to 20%. He was on the dialysis list, and that was just going organic. But these kids reversed quickly. It takes about 4 weeks. And when you have a kid who's been autistic for years, that's a miracle, but the whole family gets better. So the main culprits are, and it has to do with the way that these kids now have leaky guts. Almost everyone I see has some degree of intestinal permeability, Paul.
Yep. So hear this well, folks. Parents, it's in your hands to make this transition for your family. No, it's not easy, but it's simple, but not easy. You know, you just got to get the pesticides and the herbicides and the toxins out of the diet and remove the foods that the child is sensitive to. Sounds easy, it's hard, but it's so worth it, right? I mean, gosh.
And you know, Paul, I mean, I give parents sources, books, websites on how to make the transition. And I talk to parents that it's not perfection, it's a journey. And getting people to change the food from themselves and adults is one of the hardest things I've ever done because half of my practice were adults. But those autistic kids often have insomnias or they don't sleep. So when you have chronically tired parents who are up all night and the whole family's up all night because the kid is awake all night, they are more motivated to make those changes. And when they do, it's just shocking. You have to teach people how to reshop, how to restock their pantry, how to use crockpot cooking, how to set up meals on weekends. Like that was one of my favorite tools when I was working and my kids were little, is I do all the prep on Sunday and I made several meals at once. All these types of tips. And I actually have families in my community in Marin County that I grouped the families together so they would share. Yes, we had a bunch of kids who were gluten dairy sensitive. One mom, it seemed to be moms, made the meal and they would bring trays over to the other families. So families only had to cook a few times a week. Imagine that. You could be creative and work with your neighbors, especially if they eat the way you do.
You know, last time I had you on, we ran out of time and I forgot to ask you a really important question. So I'm going to just throw it in right here. How do people get a hold of your information? Because you just said you give them resources. Is there some place you can send people or they can find out how to get a hold of your resources?
Absolutely. So I co-founded and I am now the CEO of GMOscience.org. And I used to have all kinds of websites that I was running and I was making myself absolutely batty. So I put them all together just recently under one. And I have a parent section with videos, articles, advice. And I'm working on a second book called Making Our Children Well, teaching people about food as medicine, being a solutionary, teaching nutrition and homeopathy. And I think if parents could learn nutrition and homeopathy back in the homes, and even our parents or my grandparents did, we can bring healthy families back. That's all I'm really focused on right now is literally food is medicine.
Wow. And there is nothing more important. I think I'm working on a book also that's going to come out this year, Vax Facts, and the subtitle isn't quite locked down, but we put the vaccine information together with the nutrition information and parents, you're all set. But you got to get these books when they come out. And then in the meantime, you've got that website to get the information that you're providing. I wanted to talk to you today about something that's just distressing me to no end. And I imagine you also. And that is, okay, we've just gone through COVID. And How has, in your opinion, how has that changed pediatrics and how we should look at pediatrics? Imagine you have some thoughts about this.
Oh, indeed I do. It's hard to be married to me, Paul. Let me tell you, my poor husband. So, what I think the biggest issue that is driving me to just literally to the edge now is that that our children's health has changed because of the COVID vaccine. Let me be frank. During COVID, during the first year of COVID, and I was seeing sick kids with COVID, I was doing acute care for a practice, and I saw lots of COVID kids. They sailed through it. Parents might have been sick for a while, but kids handled COVID really well. And out of four practitioners and lots of COVID cases, especially in that first year, Paul, I think we had one sick kid who had underlying autoimmune disease. That was it. Everybody else sailed through. In comes the vaccine, June of 2021. We started seeing right away cases of myocarditis. And I know now, because of the high vax rate in kids, we did first over 12, then the 5 to 11, now the over 6 months, that because of spikeopathy, spike proteinitis, and all the other problems with the COVID vaccine, that the practice of pediatrics has changed because kids' health have changed. Let me give you an example. Pre-COVID, let's say you had an 11-year-old with chest pain. Most common, costochondritis, right? A little TT syndrome. Maybe some, they pulled their ribs and they have some local tenderness. Kids with cardiac disease, almost never. Now, there's never, never. Almost never. We weren't doing troponin and D-dimers in kids. 11-year-old now who's had three vaccines and has chest pain, I'm thinking, okay, I need a troponin. I need a D-dimer. I need a, you know, echocardiogram. Make sure we get an EKG. Troponin measures a cardiac infarction, which is a heart attack. And they have a high sensitivity troponin level now, which looks at if there's been cardiac injury. D-dimer is a test which looks at products of coagulation, because we know that the vaccine can cause some coagulation issues. And the D-dimer can measure something called fibrinogen and whether there's been damage in this coagulation system. The cardiac echo could look at, echocardiogram can look at the actual function of the heart in 3D in real time. An EKG would measure the electrophysiologic changes in the heart and to see if there's been any injury like a heart attack called an infarct. And so that's what we want to look at. We also want to do something called a high sensitivity CRP, C-reactive protein, which is a very sensitive measure of inflammation. I am seeing these numbers to be abnormal. Now, Paul, for in full disclosure, I don't see as many patients as I used to because I'm teaching and writing more and not as much in the saddle of practice as I used to be. But I still have some vaccine injured kids that I'm caring for, young adults too, because these young boys, 20, 25, 30 years old, are particularly at risk. And so looking at these cardiac markers, that was unheard of before. That would be one thing. The second thing would be stroke. When I saw, I think it was in 2022, that they were promoting a new pediatric stroke drug, I thought, oh yeah, they're covering their butts because we know that the COVID vaccine can cause thrombotic events. Yes, coagulopathies of sort. I don't know exactly if we'd call them coagulopathies or abnormal protein formations. And so stroke in a kid, maybe cerebral palsy, maybe perinatal anoxia, maybe in a premature baby, maybe one in 200,000. And now we're seeing kids with strokes. Unheard of. So this is what I'm meaning now. So when I have a kid now, a family member has a painful vein right now. So thrombophlebitis in a young person, I'm thinking, now, that, okay, thrombophlebitis, a young person, now I'm thinking, is there endothelial injury from the COVID vaccine? See, so my thinking has shifted 100% because I don't believe the COVID vaccine is benign.
Oh.
And so there, that's my position on it. This is my opinion. And that's what I'm sharing with you.
Yeah. So I had a similar, I was still practicing, I'm retired now. And by the way, folks, nothing we say on this program is meant to be diagnostic or medical advice. Run it by your trusted healthcare provider. We're just two pediatricians sharing our experience here. I was in a busy practice with 10,000 patients, five providers, more a few years before that. But not a single child, your experience exactly, not a single child had a significant COVID illness when COVID hit for that whole first year. And the parents, some of them got a little sicker. grandparents, a few of them ended up in the hospital. As soon as that vaccine was rolled out, I had a child hospitalized for myocarditis. We weren't giving the vaccine in my office. This was just, they go to the pharmacy. Once they were 11 years old, they could go get it. Got the shot, ended up in the hospital with severe myocarditis. First case I'd ever seen in my career. Sounds like you've had a lot of firsts since that vaccine has been rolled out. What do you suppose? I'm just thinking of the younger pediatricians who don't have our perspective. You know, we practice for 30, 40 years. 40, I think it is. We're probably both at 40 plus at this point, although I'm retired. We've seen a lot, but we weren't seeing anything like the kind of conditions we're seeing with this COVID jab that is definitely clearly causing harm.
When I think back in my career, mine too, I spent decades in pediatric emergency medicine. I think I've saw one case of myocarditis. I have many cases of myocarditis, and not even compared to what someone like Dr. McCullough or Malhotra, what other cardiologists are now seeing as we refer these kids to pediatric cardiologists. The problem is we send them off to see the specialist, either the cardiologist or, you know, whichever we're looking for help. And they're not looking at the vaccine as a cause, and they're just treating the symptoms, and they don't even understand why the kids have gotten into a problem. I have one pediatrician colleague who, when I said, but why are you offering the COVID vaccine? Are you seeing myocarditis? He goes, yeah, we're seeing myocarditis. And I said, well, I mean, what's your thoughts on that? And he said to me, a love pediatrician, well, someone has to take one for the team.
Love.
That stuck with me like forever. And this was during COVID. This was toward the end of COVID. So I understood he was still in that fear mode, but I never heard of anything so awful that we should protect adults and hurt children, right? That was a nagging school grandma. Although we know that was all fictitious anyway, the COVID vaccine never stopped transmission. That's pretty clear. I'm not seeing these type of issues. And what we're also seeing are these very weird atypical issues, bizarre neurologic symptoms, lots of things related to something called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardias, lots of changes in people's nervous systems that regulate things like breathing and heart rate. It's called the autonomic nervous system. And these type of disorders are very rare in kids. Guillain-Barré, not common. Cerebellar, where your motor system sits, disorders. Kids with bizarre motor function things, kids in wheelchairs. We've seen it all. Kids with bizarre rashes. I've seen every type of issue that I can attribute to the vaccine because I've done the research and it's out there. And it's in VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It's in VAERS. Every type of issue that can develop, myalgias, muscle aches, total body fatigue, total body pain. I had one kid with just pain from head to toe, took five. And the symptoms are bizarre. And if that's not bad enough, so now how we view children has changed, but the system is not set up or even acknowledges the issues that our kids are facing. So we have kids with new issues and a system that is ill-prepared or unprepared or denies the issues and cannot take care of them. So these parents, I feel so sorry for parents with a vaccine-injured child, which we even know from the previous vaccines, even though the COVID vaccine is not really a vaccine, it's a genetic immunomodulating therapy, injection. And so the parents are struggling, and I get it. I absolutely feel for parents now because parents are trying to do the right thing or encouraged to get the vaccines and demanded to get the vaccines to go to school in California, the kids had to take the COVID shot. And, you know, a lot of parents can't keep their kids at home because they work. Oh, parents were put in an awful position. Absolutely.
Oh, horrendous. Horrendous. This seems to be the most harmful shot that's ever been put on the market. How the heck did the CDC and then the AAP go along with this, and it's now on the childhood schedule starting at 6 months of age, and in states where you can't get an exemption, like you said, like in California, parents are in this spot where they have to give the shot or basically homeschool their kid or leave the state. What's your advice? I mean, you've seen enough harm now that you can passionately talk to the parent that's watching who's in that position where they're saying, I don't know what to do. I have to work. What what would you do if you were in that position, knowing what you know now?
Knowing what I know now, this is what I would do. As a parent, because I love children, and like you parents out there, if you love your kids, I would homeschool them. You say homeschool, I need to go in to go to work. Can you create a community homeschool with other parents in your area where you only maybe have to have the kids one day a week or one evening a week or one weekend day if you work during the week? Can you create communities around homeschooling? So that would be my first priority, is you have to get them out of the school system. Because the school system, let's say here in California, we have almost 40 million people here, lots of kids. So the school system is a problem if they're mandating vaccines, and they still are, particularly the COVID vaccines. If you can't do homeschooling, I would leave. I would leave California. That's what I would do personally, Michelle. Yeah. Michelle would head on out with, if my kids were small. I looked to leave California during COVID, and for various reasons wound up not going. We do a podcast also called The New MDs, and we just had the wonderful Dr. Mackus on, and he's a Canadian oncologist. And I personally asked Dr. Mackus yesterday, it seems that that third shot is the worst. And he said, and he was talking about with each shot, you have increasing developing antibody, particularly one called IgG4. And you can develop antibody, something called antibody-dependent enhancement. And with each of these shots, your immune system literally gets taken out and no longer recognizes pathogens and malignant cells. Yeah. And we were talking in terms of turbo cancers, but it also is particularly important in terms of prevention of immune dysfunction, autoimmunity, and cancers in our children, because sometimes cancers can develop later as kids get older. And that's what Dr. Mackus said. Some of the cancers he's seeing really now in the late teens. And our practices are here have informed me, pediatricians, that their practices are starting to see leukemias, which is the most common pediatric cancer still, followed by brain tumors. So we were talking about cancers yesterday, turbo cancers, Paul, let's just be clear. But I'm also seeing now, I have quite a few parents reaching out to me, their kids' immune systems are not working. The kids are picking up every illness, young and old, in school and not, whether they're in preschool or college, and the illnesses are lasting a long time, and they're more virulent than they used to be. And the kids are getting sick with every illness. And mostly all those kids were vaccinated with at least one, and most of them at least three shots.
Yeah. And that's been my experience. And back when I was in practice, my sick waiting room was empty most of the time. My well waiting room was packed. That speaks to the health of children who have a natural, robust immune system, whose immune system has not been shifted towards allergy, autoimmunity, and just in the case of the COVID jab being totally just shut down. It's got to stop. And parents, it's up to you, because the system is apparently unwilling or incapable or so captured that our medical system is in trouble.
And Paul, what's your sense? It seems to me that practices are still dismissing families that are asking for no vaccines or delayed vaccine schedule. And this is what I'm hearing in California. Okay. In my Northern California region, I don't know if this is a national phenomenon where parents are still getting abandoned by practices and being asked to exit. Is it your experience that that is still happening?
Yeah, it's still happening. I travel speaking around the country and I hear that same story. It's happening everywhere. Parents are in this dilemma where in many communities, there's nowhere to go. Every pediatrician insists on following the CDC schedule or you can't attend their practice. My old practice has continued under a different ownership and a different name. And so I've inquired, how are you guys busy? Because I thought maybe with my exit, they would sort of dwindle and disappear. They're busier than ever because they're the only clinic in town that honors informed consent, that will allow parents to do what they want to do once they've had all the information shared. And I mean, they go and they say, this is what the CDC says you're supposed to do, but then here's the risks and benefits. And yeah, those are rare. It's hard to find. So our pediatric specialty is in trouble. It's absolutely.
I would agree. And you know, what I've been counseling folks to do is, we have an insurance issue as well, which sick kids, a system ill-prepared to care for them, and then parents whose insurance cover the system that's ill-prepared to care for the kids. Right. So what I've been counseling people to do, if possible, when possible, some can do it, some can, is, can you get just some kind of emergency coverage for emergencies and then opt for some holistic coverage? And there are some like Good Samaritan, and there are others that they can look into, or, you know, create your own fund with a family. I had a family with 25 family members that created their own insurance, where they all funded this one account, and they used it for their, you know, their integrative practitioners. Most integrative practitioners do not take insurance, whether you're seeing your acupuncturist, your chiropractor, your DO, your naturopathic doctor, any integrative pediatricians like us, whomever. And so we don't take insurance. Why? Because our visits take so long. And I feel for regular pediatricians who are in the system, the model, the HMO model, where they're seeing 3, 4, 5 kids an hour. And turning out, you can't do the kind of care we're talking about when a pediatrician is seeing 4 or 5 kids an hour. Impossible. It's just, it's literally just writing a script and getting the family out the door. It's awful. It's just awful. So that system is not working. So parents have to be creative with their health insurance.
Yeah. No, I agree. Absolutely. Get catastrophic coverage for those rare things, God forbid, that you end up with a severe accident or cancer or something horrible. But then put your money where you want it to, in a place where you're promoting wellness. I mean, that is the key. You're spot on. And so I think I'll let you close out with, what are the most important keys to wellness care? Because you've got a book coming. And so you can give us a little tease about what you think is most important.
So what I think is most important is food is medicine. Let your kitchen, your pantry be your medicine chest. La cocina es tu medicina. The kitchen is your medicine, right there. Teaching homeopathy at home, and that's coming, how every family can get their home homeopathic kit and learn to use those remedies when their kids are sick. And I would be remiss, we talked about so many things, that love your bugs in your gut, love your microbiome, because what we saw is that COVID vaccine took out the microbes. And when I went and took a look at that on other vaccines, didn't see any data regarding other shots and other therapies on the microbiome effects. So could this be happening to all the vaccines, to all the medications? Possibly, yes. So you want to love that microbiome, protect those kids' bugs. And here's a little tip. As you make these transitions, remember, there, while you're doing all these wonderful things, a little bit of apple cider vinegar, organic, please, that you give your child every day on their salad dressing and their water, just like a small kid is a teaspoon, a big kid, it might be a tablespoon, breaks down glyphosate, acetobacter. So include that apple cider vinegar, lemon in the water, alkalinizing, decrease sugar, no sugar, decrease sugar. Berries are fine. Fruits are okay. No extra sugar. They don't need it. And you be that soccer mom or dad who brings the oranges or tangerines to soccer practice and not the cupcakes. Yes, you be that parent, and as well as sleepovers and other events. Be the model parent for all the other families and in your community. You'll be the change.
Wow. Let's put up how people can get a hold of you, because I know you do have a website, gmoscience.org, that is just a great resource. Thank you for putting that up. And I'm sure when your book's available, they can get access to it at that website as well. I can't thank you enough, Michelle. Thank you once again for joining Pediatric Perspectives.
Paul, a pleasure. Anytime.
You can check out my other show, With the Wind, at doctorsinscience.com. You can also reach me directly, even book a coaching session if you wish, at kidsfirstforever.com, the number 4. Both these links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week. I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.